Don't worry, I'm not going to preach the whole three chapters today, but just make an introduction and we'll spend the summer here. Today, only the first two verses of chapter 5. Have you ever heard, or maybe you've said the phrase, "This is straight from the horse's mouth"? You familiar with that phrase? Straight from the horse's mouth. What does that mean? Does it mean this information is directly from the original source? Or maybe this is the best information possible? I looked at an internet website, wordhistories.net, that tells us about the origin of such words and phrases. And it said that that phrase originated in horse racing and gambling. And it's the earliest that they could found in print is a London newspaper from 1861 regarding betting advice on a horse race. Straight from the horse's mouth. You see, the advice was meant to be so good, it was if the horse himself was telling you how the race was going to be. That's the kind of information you want, straight from the horse's mouth. Now, in Western circles, there is a legend that it comes from reading a horse's teeth to age the horse, right? Some of you are probably capable of that, to look at a horse's teeth and say how old the horse is. Now, a horse trader might fudge on the age of the horse a bit. So if you're buying a horse, it's good to be able to look into his mouth and judge his teeth and know how old he is. Straight from the horse's mouth. I don't know which is more true. It doesn't really matter. My purpose for bringing it up is to introduce the Sermon on the Mount to say that this is words from Jesus himself. This is primary teaching from Jesus of Nazareth on how to be kingdom people. And so it's important, I think, for us as followers of Jesus to know and to use this as a standard to live by. Now, the form we have is in English. Jesus didn't speak these words in English. But we're grateful for the translations that we have. And I believe with all my soul that what Matthew recorded and has been preserved for us and translated for us is an accurate representation of Jesus' teaching. Matthew's 5, 6, and 7. Now, Luke has a shorter version in his gospel. In chapter 6 of Luke, there is a bit of the Sermon on the Mount. It's sometimes called, in Luke's version, the Sermon on the Mound or on the flat place. And he has only 4 Beatitudes and then 4 woes. Matthew has 8 Beatitudes. Why the difference? Maybe this is Jesus' teaching, but it is not the exact sermon that he preached at an exact time on an exact day. I believe, as Matthew puts it, that there was a specific day or set of days that Jesus went into the hills with his disciples near the Sea of Galilee, and I think he taught these things. But if you just read this, if you just read those 3 chapters, you would find it would take about the same amount of time as a typical contemporary sermon would take. But it's the topics are varied and it's complex. It's not the sort of thing that we would preach as a single sermon today. I think it is a set of teaching. I don't think that it was, like I said, a single sermon that Jesus preached and then passed the offering plate on a single Sunday morning. In fact, I doubt it was a Sunday morning. And I'm rambling. I think that Jesus taught these things over and over. This is his core teaching, and he continued to teach these things. Matthew presents this material as happening very early in Jesus' ministry, as he was preaching to and healing people and all the crowds that were coming around him when he was ministering around the Sea of Galilee. And Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 and 2 gives us some information about the audience and about his purpose that day. And I think Matthew is telling us about a particular event that's accurate, and it included this teaching. Matthew 5, verse 1. Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. You see, the crowds kept coming. By this time, everywhere Jesus went, there were more and more crowds. They wanted to see this man who could do such miracles. They wanted to hear his teaching because it was exciting. Sometimes they got free food. And they just kept coming. They just kept coming. And so Jesus retreated into the hills. He withdrew into the hills. He had to get away from the crowds. And he called those who were already his disciples, those who were beginning to be committed to following him, up on the hill. And he sat down. That's what rabbis did in that day. They sat to teach. And when you saw the rabbi sat down, it's a cue to listen up. And you can imagine Jesus. I wonder if he quietly walked up the hill and those who were observant and serious about him followed him. Or I wonder if he went and gathered some and said, come on up. We don't even, as Matthew presents it, we're not even sure he had all 12 apostles identified at this point publicly. I'm not sure, but he goes up on the hill to teach, and he brings with him those that are committed. They are serious to follow him. They're already part of the kingdom. What I'm saying here, this wasn't an evangelistic message in our terminology. This wasn't come follow me. It's I'm going to tell you how to follow me. In our contemporary terms, we call it discipleship. How to be disciples of Jesus. In these three chapters, we find that first of all, there's a description of real disciple character. Jesus started with character. Now, you know that our behavior, our choices, and our attitudes come out of our character. I mean, you can imitate things. You can fool some of the people some of the time, but your character eventually comes out in your behavior. And Jesus started with character. And then, we can change our character. And most of us need to at some point or another, don't we? We need to improve our character. And so here we have teaching to help us to know what kind of character to build. And then as the sermon goes on, there's more about specific choices and specific activities. And it describes how to have the right relationship with God. And it ends in chapter 7 with some information about judging true disciple behavior. And I think it's meant for us to judge ourselves, to help us measure ourselves against the pattern that Jesus set. And so Jesus took these who were committed to him into the hills, up the mountain, Matthew says. Kind of reminds us of some Old Testament characters going up the mountain to meet with God. You remember Abraham, God called him to go up the mountain and take Isaac as a sacrifice. And he met God there in a powerful way. And God supplied a sacrifice instead of Abraham's only son. It might remind you of Moses going up Mount Sinai to meet with God while the nation is camped at the foot of the mountain. And Moses was called up. And what did God give him when he went up the mountain? He laid out the law. He even wrote it on the stone for Moses to take down to the people. What was the law? For ancient Israel, for Israel who had just come out of Egyptian bondage. What was the law? How to follow God. God wanted them to know, I've called you out of the world. I've called you out of Egypt, and I want you to be my people. You're going to be different from the rest of the world. I'm going to take you to the land that I promised to Abraham when he came out from his land and his people. God's in the business of calling people out of this world to be his own. And the law on Mount Sinai was to show them, to teach them how to be God's people. Now, their first few steps were mistaken, and they ended up in the desert for 40 years. We don't need to wander for 40 years. We can pay attention to his word and know how to live. And so Jesus called his disciples up to the mountain to teach them how to be his followers, how to be kingdom people. John Stott he's passed on now, but a famous preacher in England. And he described this sermon as a Christian counterculture. Throughout the Bible, we have records of God's calling people out for himself, just as Jesus did on that day. Now, Stott also said, we need to ask three questions of this text that Matthew says is Jesus' teaching. And Stott says, we need to ask some questions about it. And I'm going to borrow his questions this morning. First of all, is it authentic? Is it really from Jesus? The second question he asked, is it relevant today? Does it really matter to us? And the third question he asked, is it practical? In other words, are the standards described in this sermon even attainable for us today? Is it possible to live up to this message? Is it practical? So let's take those questions in order, and I'm going to rely on Stott and some other writers to help answer those questions. The first one is this teaching authentic to Jesus? Do you have a red letter Bible? There's a little bit of evidence for you. If you have a red letter version, it's in red, isn't it? Now, that's not completely conclusive. Some men chose whether to put what should be red letters, but they do it after study. And there's years and years of study gone into that. It wasn't just willy-nilly, some of it's going to be red and some of it's going to be black. This is the history of the church speaking. We believe these are authentic words of Jesus. And if yours doesn't have red letters, it doesn't mean you have a defective Bible. It just means it was printed differently. Matthew records that. Matthew tells us this is what Jesus said. Matthew was inspired by the Holy Spirit to write these things, to record them. The church has been inspired by the Holy Spirit to protect them and canonize them as teaching of Jesus. As I said, Matthew describes this teaching as happening at a particular time on a particular day, and I think that's accurate. I think Jesus also retaught these principles wherever he went. And so Luke having a little bit different version is perfectly normal, because when you speak to different crowds at different places, you emphasize different points. You might not present all of it at once. This could have easily have been a whole day or periods of several days. But I think it's accurate that Jesus took his disciples into the hills to get them away from the crowds and concentrate on what was needed. Stott wrote that he reckons this sermon did not occur in a single hour of a single day, but is a condensed summary of the teaching. Another fellow, R.T. France, calls it an anthology of Jesus' teaching. I guess he wrote that because it was a nice contemporary term. It's an accurate representation of Jesus' teaching. Every source I looked at, even if they presented some wild theories, and there are some. I mean, there are some teachers who would say, this is just a moral code that some disciples made up later. Some people actually believe that. There is some moral codeness to this, but it's more than that. Every one of the sources I read came back to saying, this is the real stuff. This is from Jesus on how his disciples should live. And so the first question, is it authentic? Yes. You don't need to struggle over it. Is it relevant for today? Is this old teaching on a hillside near the Sea of Galilee helpful for you today? Well, let me just ask you a few questions. Is our character important? Does it matter how we influence other people? I'm thinking if you're talking to your children, you care about it. Is it important to demonstrate righteous living? Is our religious practice important both privately and publicly? Does it matter what we value most? Do your priorities matter? Could you use some good advice on relationships with other people? Apparently, there are a lot of us who need advice on relationships because it's on every bookshelf and every bookstore, on radio programs, and counselors make a good living trying to help us with our relationships. Does it matter to whom or to what we commit ourselves? If you've answered yes to any or all of those questions, then the Sermon on the Mount matters. It is relevant for today, for our lives. Now again, it was meant for Jesus' followers. I don't think Jesus expected the world to live up to his standards. But he does expect his followers to live up to his standards. The third question is it practical? Is it attainable? Or do these three chapters describe some perfect person who doesn't even live in this world? Some would say, this is what you can expect to be like in heaven, but you're never going to get there on this earth. Well, you may not get it perfect, but is this attainable? Listen, Jesus knew people. He knows people now. He knows our corruption. He knows our shortcomings. He expects that we're not going to get it right every day. But he laid out some good standards for us, and they're lofty. The goals are high. He wouldn't set low standards for his people. He understands our imperfections. He knows we're broken people. At another time, he said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and broken. I'll give you rest. Take my load, my yoke, for it's easy compared to what you normally drag around. Live like I tell you to live. You'll like it better." We can live the way Jesus asked to live. Like I said, we will not always get it perfect. It's a lifelong pursuit. It's not a one-time event by any means. But on this side of heaven, it's a good way to live. It's a life of peace and healthy living as Jesus describes it. There is some value as a moral and ethical code, but it is more than that. And like I said, it's not expected of the world. This teaching is directed at Jesus' followers. Now, living by Jesus' standards also prepares us for heaven. How long is heaven going to last? How long is eternity? Wouldn't you like to be ready for it? Wouldn't you like to know what it's about? Jesus shows us. You remember his prayer? It's in chapter 6. May your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We can experience some heaven now, perhaps if we live by his standards. It also says in chapter 6, do not worry about treasures in this life, but store up treasures in heaven. God's not going to force you into eternity in heaven. In fact, if you don't want eternity in heaven, he's not going to force you there. He will let you go your own way. So don't bother with this if that's what you want. If you're not interested in following Jesus and being committed to his ways, well, I don't know why you'd be here if you weren't interested. Chapter 6, it says, seek his kingdom and his righteousness first. Then all the other things will be added. Do you remember when Jesus was asked, what is the greatest commandment? He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Guess what he's teaching in this sermon, in this set of teaching? How to love God, how to love your neighbor. If you boil it down, that's the essentials that we find here. How to love God and love your neighbor. Is it a coincidence that Jesus' core teaching matches what he said are the greatest commandments? No. It's not a coincidence. He's consistent. And the word is consistent. This discourse here begins with 8 broad standards of character. We call them the Beatitudes. And I want to conclude today by reading those statements in chapter 5. What we call the Beatitudes, and then we're going to spend most of the summer on those. Matthew 5, verse 1. Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. He said, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Now, I'm not going to preach through that today. We're going to take one per Sunday throughout the summer. Let me just say, though, these are not separate categories of separate kinds of people. You can't just pick one and say, that's my beatitude. That's the guy or gal I'm going to be. These are for every Christian of every day that ever has been. These are standards for us to work toward all of our lives. So dig in. I told you from the beginning, I want to whet your appetite today. I want you to spend some time in these chapters through the summer. We've said over and over that we want to be about making disciples who make disciples. Well, here's some core material that will help us be disciples and will help us teach people to teach people how to be disciples.